From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, the plethora of newly formed political parties in Milwaukee and how might they affect next year's mayoral race and incumbent Tom Barrett.
He clearly would not need financial support, but he would be more likely to get support in terms of ground troops. And that could be what he would need particularly.
Later, film contributor Dave Lurson explains what makes an Oscar-winning Best Picture.
I mean, really, it should be all of the elements, including the cast, that somehow come together in this scintillating chemical combustion of greatness, hopefully.
And writer, cartoonist, and Milwaukee native Paul Noth channels his experience growing up with eight siblings in his latest middle grade novel.
I grew up with this idea of like there's sort of a complicated group dynamic or sort of political palace intrigue going on among the siblings and who has power and who doesn't.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders officially threw his hat into the ring yesterday, announcing he's again running for president. That brings the number of people who have announced their candidacies to 12, with several more people reportedly close to making an announcement. And that's just people seeking the Democratic nomination in 2020.
There will also be some key local races on the ballot in 2020, including the Milwaukee mayoral race. That and many other local races are officially nonpartisan elections. And while candidates often skew along partisan lines, there are an interesting number of political parties that have started to endorse candidates and wield political influence.
Writer Larry Sandler digs into what these parties are, what they're about, and what they hope to accomplish, all in the February issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and he is with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be here.
What is the reason that this group of political parties that are sort of different than the parties we are used to has cropped up in Wisconsin and the Milwaukee area in particular?
Well, you know, here in Milwaukee County, as in many other places in the country, most of our elections are nonpartisan, and as also is true with many big cities, the few that are partisan have been dominated by one party, by the Democratic Party, and that creates sort of a vacuum. And you would expect that in an environment like that, people compete by themselves, individual candidates, but the stakes are big. And so some parties have decided, some individuals or interests have decided that they want to have a little more influence. And from different perspectives, whether the left or the right, they want to have a little more influence on these officially nonpartisan elections, as well as in Democratic Party primaries. And so we've seen this emergence of groups that are outside the traditional two-party structure.
Well, and so how do these parties function like traditional political parties, and how do they function differently?
Well, each of these groups is different. So two of the groups that I profiled, the Working Families, Wisconsin Working Families Party and Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, operate on a very grassroots sort of model. They are not big money parties, but they are people power parties where they focus on volunteers. And so that is similar to the party function of having volunteers out on the streets, making calls, talking to people one-on-one. So they bring that part of the party function. And in both of those cases, they have a more progressive orientation. The other two groups that I profiled are Leadership MKE and Milwaukeeans for Self-Governance. And they are focused much more on the big money aspect of politics. And they operate some advice for candidates, but more financial contributions, and not even necessarily financial contributions directly to the candidates, but more of independent spending, where they will put on ads and send out literature independent of the candidates. And in the case of Milwaukeeans for Self-Governance, that's more from a right-wing conservative perspective. In the case of Leadership MKE, It reflects County Executive Abele's views, which are somewhat unique.
Well, and, you know, in thinking about this, as you say, the Democratic Party dominates a lot of politics, certainly in the city of Milwaukee and also in large parts of Milwaukee County. Is this a way for candidates and potential candidates to sort of further distinguish themselves and identify themselves with a particular wing of the party?
It can be. It can be a way, you know, particularly through the Wisconsin Working Families Party. They are focused on the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party, although they are careful to say that they don't function as a wing of the Democratic Party and they make their own decisions. But you do see that in Democratic primaries, they endorse the candidates who are more towards the left. Their national organization endorsed Bernie Sanders, and so that gives you an idea of their orientation. The other one, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, is focused very much on the African-American community, but also from a progressive perspective. And so they are focused on the candidates that are serving their particular niches.
Who's had the most success in terms of their ability to kind of meet their aims?
So I actually did do an analysis of winners and losers. And what I found is that Working Families Party has had the most success so far. 26 of the 32 candidates that they endorsed for local offices in the Milwaukee and Racine areas were successful. And compared to Leadership MKE, 11 out of 18, which was 61%. It was harder to calculate percentages for the other two. Well, in the case of Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, really the only local race that they've gotten involved in so far is the sheriff's race. And so I guess in that sense, they had 100% success because their candidate, Ernell Lucas, came out ahead. It was harder to calculate with Milwaukeeans for Self-Governance because Craig Peterson, the organizer, won't really say entirely who he endorsed because to some extent that's a stigma. And he recognizes, he's a smart politician, he recognizes that to some extent his support is a stigma for some candidates.
It's odd, though, for a party to not want to publicize who it's supporting.
Yeah, that's correct. But again, because he is taking a what's called a dark money approach where his contributors are secret and his support is a little less obvious. We did see he announced certain people that he supported in certain aldermanic races and certainly for the mayor's race and the district attorney's race.
Well, and at the end of the day, when someone goes to the polls in a local or municipal election, these are still nonpartisan elections. These party endorsements don't show up on the ballot, right?
That's absolutely true. And so you will only see the name of the candidate. And the only way that you know that they're endorsed by one of these groups is if you got literature or if you got a phone call or a visit from somebody who was on behalf of that particular organization.
You mentioned Racine. Is there any possibility that the influence of these parties might extend beyond Milwaukee and now to some degree in Racine?
Certainly, the Wisconsin Working Families Party, by its name, has statewide aspirations. But they have started out in southeastern Wisconsin. The others so far are focused primarily in the Milwaukee area, however that's defined.
Well, and there's one name that we really haven't mentioned much in this, and that's we mentioned Chris Abele, but you know, it's also worth mentioning that that Mayor Barrett is not technically, as the mayor, you know, holds a nonpartisan office. Where does he fall in this mix?
Oh, well, that's a really good question because the mayor is up for election in 2020. And as far as we know, he's running for re-election. He hasn't officially declared that. And none of these organizations have officially endorsed him. Milwaukeeans for Self-Governance, if it's active, can be expected to oppose him as they did in 2016. But I did try to talk to these organizations about what their role would be in the 2020 elections. It was not clear in the case of leadership, MKE, they just actually did not get back to me. The others were kind of vague and said, well, you know, we're looking at it. We'll see what you know, who's on our side, who aligns with our issues. And so it definitely remains to be seen how all of these organizations are going to be active in the 2020 elections.
And from the standpoint of a campaign war chest, it's unclear whether Mayor Barrett would need the support of one of these kinds of parties at any rate.
He clearly would not need financial support, but he would be more likely to get support in terms of ground troops. And that could be what he would need particularly.
Larry Sandler, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Larry Sandler's article on political parties in southeastern Wisconsin is in the February issue of Milwaukee Magazine. There is a link to it from WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now and then look at the City of Milwaukee's Children's Savings Account Initiative and what it could mean for MPS students. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Low-income students in Milwaukee are less likely to graduate from high school and go on to college than their wealthier counterparts. A new program by the City of Milwaukee is hoping to bridge that gap.
Fund My Future Milwaukee is part of a growing movement around the nation which seeks to create college savings accounts for students. Ashley Edgerson is the manager of the Fund My Future Milwaukee program. Sharon Robinson is the director of Milwaukee's Department of Administration, and she is one of the driving forces behind the program.
They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and Robinson starts by explaining the origins of the initiative.
This children's savings account initiative called Fund My Future Milwaukee emerged from the city's growing prosperity plan, and that was an economic development plan that was introduced about 2 to 3 years ago, and it's a plan that really is community-centric, and it puts people first, as well as the need to connect residents to jobs and opportunity in the city. So there's a chapter in Growing Prosperity about human capital development. And in that chapter, it highlighted some disparities that we all know about. Clearly, there's wealth inequality, there's educational disparities, and we also have problems in terms of the workforce. We know that the jobs of the future require higher education, and actually the jobs of today require higher education. So we know that in Milwaukee that we need to close some of these gaps in order to better our community as well as provide opportunity to residents. So in Chapter 5 of Growing Prosperity, there was an action item that said the city should explore introducing a citywide children's savings account program as a means to increasing educational aspirations and preparing youth for the jobs of the future. So I agreed to take that action item on, and we had a host of community partners, and United Way has been with us since day one. Greater Milwaukee Foundation has also been in the work group. EdVest, which is the college savings plan for the state of Wisconsin. Journey House, the FDIC. So many, many partners who came together to explore this idea. And today, we are actually poised to introduce this program to Milwaukee and actually launch it formally this school year.
That's great. Ashley, I know you just came on to the project.
Yeah.
but how do the accounts work? So it's a savings account for the future, funding kids' futures. How does the account work?
Sure. So the way that the program is going to work is EdVest is a sort of a master account. So basically what's going to happen is I will have an incentive program that works through 15 schools of our selection. And then those 15 schools will then get extra incentives in order to participate in the program. What I will say, though, is that we plan to seed all K-5 kindergarten students in the city first with $25, and then unless the parents decide to opt out. But for the most part, the account will work directly through EdVest.
Okay, so if I'm getting this right, you're going to launch it at 13 schools initially, but all kindergartners will start with it?
All K-5 kindergartners in the city of Milwaukee will be seated with $25 in the event their parents do not decide to opt out of the program. However, we will then take 15 schools from different sectors and work with them closely through an incentive program. And so that'll give the students, those particular K-5 kindergartners, the opportunity to receive additional funds into their accounts.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly a program of this scale, we really do want to test the incentive portion of the program before we roll it out to all schools. So the first year, it's 15 schools, and we'll ramp up to about 65 the second year. And the third year program operations, we plan to serve all of the kids with the incentive portion of the program.
Okay.
And so basically, they'll get bonus rewards or additional funds for achieving behavioral milestones like good attendance, behaving well in school, taking part in our events and activities.
Okay. This model, has it been used in other cities before? Have we seen it in other municipalities?
Yes, and it's important to point out that Milwaukee really has joined this growing CSA movement. In fact, there's lots of these programs going on across the nation. There are actually 54 programs operating in 32 states, serving about 400,000 students. So we have been a part of this movement, and we're attached to national networks, regional networks, and we're very, very happy that we're able to benefit from the experience of others. There's about 15 years of research on CSAs, and research shows that children with $500 or less in savings are much more likely to graduate high school and move on to college.
At the end of the K through 12 tenure of an MPS student, how much do you expect they will have in this savings account?
That's a good question, but it's a very difficult question to answer. And I should point out that we're in our fundraising mode right now. Clearly, a program that serves 8,800 kids a year takes a robust fundraising effort. So essentially, we are crunching numbers on what it could look like in terms of at the end of the day, based on incentivizing behavior over about 3 years. But so essentially what we're saying is the kids will get the account seated at 25, and then the opportunity to receive about $40 extra in incentive money. So if you look at it like when they graduate high school, I would say like the minimum amount would be somewhere between the $750 to $1,000 range. But if we raise more money than we anticipate, those dollars could go up. So we're hoping that the community will really get behind this and kick in money, because clearly it's a funding issue, and the more funding we have, the more chance we'll have to make these accounts like really, really robust. But again, I want to point back to that research that says that kids with between $1 and $500 are much more likely to go to college, because many of our kids don't even have college on their radar screen. So what we really want to do is plant the seed of a college-bound identity and kids in Milwaukee, and especially the low-income children. So the program is much more about planting the seed of a college-bound identity in children in their earliest years, even though the savings is obviously important because it creates the kind of habits you need that will make you successful in high school and beyond.
So the accounts are being funded through a number of different partnerships, it seems. Are accounts attached to specific students? Is that kind of how it works? It's attached to one student as they go through MPS? Is it just while they're in MPS?
That's a good question. So the way that the program will work is that there's one master account. Each student then, as my role, each student would then get the funds that they've acquired. So that initial seed. And then any incentive, if you're participating in the incentive program, will then be added additionally as we go on. So they don't have their own accounts to where it's sort of like a checking and savings account where they can deposit or withdraw at any time. That doesn't happen. It's solely me. So they do have their own accounts, but I am the sole authority, I guess, on the account.
And I'll add to that. So essentially what Ashley's role is she will be tracking the activity on each individual student. So even though we have a master account, she has software that will allow her to input the names of each student in each cohort year after year. And once we give the $25 to start up or jumpstart the savings, the software allows us to plug in which student got the $25, which student got the incentive money. So essentially, the program tracks all of the individual activity, but the EdVest Master account is where all the money sits.
So if a student leaves MPS, if, say, they go to a charter school in the area or if they happen to move, what happens to the money that is following them?
Sure. So if we can track the student, then they can keep the funds because it would be easier to just say, okay, this student has participated. This is the funds that they have. If they, for example, move outside of our range, our county range, then the funds would just go, or they move out of state, for example, the funds would go right back into the account.
Okay.
For a different student.
For a different student. Mm-hmm. And right now the program is being rolled out with kindergarten age kids.
Mm-hmm. K-5.
Is it going to be available for people who enter into the district, for kids who are transferring in maybe when they're in second or third grade?
The program is serving K-5 kindergartners only.
Okay.
That's the way we're starting out. But again, if the fundraising effort takes off, that would give us the opportunity to decide, do we want to expand the school to other classes? But the intent right now is just to start out with K-5 kindergartners this school year and then each subsequent school year.
You know, at the end of all of this, what are you hoping the impact is, not just on the kids, but also on the schools?
In my role as the program manager, I really want to focus on the family unit as a whole. So not only are we emphasizing and getting the K-5 kindergartners excited about going to college, you know, deciding what they want to be when they grow up and sort of visualizing that end goal, I also want to start with the family. So the parents, down to potentially any, if there are any other siblings that are, could be older and may not have had this sort of awareness or education given to them or provided to them. So I ultimately want the whole family unit to be prepared for their futures financially and beyond. So I am putting together and working with the various partners to make sure that the whole concept of education, financial literacy, stability as a family unit, those all are incorporated in all aspects of the program.
This community faces some serious challenges, wealth inequality. We've got poor educational outcomes. And so the reason I took this on is I really did want to take on a bold new idea that would move the needle on educational outcomes, boost financial capability in a more large-scale way. So to me, at the end of the day, I hope this program really does change, like, just the culture in our schools and in our community on education and savings, because clearly we've got a lot of work to do to overcome these challenges. And when you're talking about 8,800 kids being served a year, it really does hold the promise of really changing the way that we look at education in this community and boosting our performance in education in other areas.
Sharon Robinson is the director of the Department of Administration for the City of Milwaukee. Ashley Edgerson is the manager of the Fund My Future Milwaukee program. They spoke with Joy Powers, and our interview with them first aired in November.
Film contributor Dave Lurson previews the Hostless Academy Awards coming your way this weekend. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. The 91st Academy Awards will be handed out this Sunday, the Oscars. 8 films are nominated for the ultimate prize of Best Picture, and people across the country will tune in to see whether their own picks for films and actors will take home golden statues.
But like many awards shows, this year's Oscars are not without some controversy. This year, there will be no host for the first time since 1989. There's also controversy surrounding 2 of the Best Picture nominees, Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody, but many are praising the diversity of films nominated, including more films made by people of color, and for the first time, a Spanish-language film is nominated in the Best Picture category.
Well, host or no host, we can guarantee that film contributor Dave Lurson will be tuned in to the Academy Awards. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio recently to discuss the nominations and the unusual hosting situation.
Maybe we don't really need a host. I mean, I think the idea was the host would draw more viewers, but I'm not sure that that's been working because viewership has not actually been on the increase.
That's true. So do you think when it comes to the films that are part of this year's Oscars, that there's as wide a spectrum as, you know, compared to last year with nominees? We have Black Panther, Black Klansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, The Favorite, Green Book, Roma, A Star Is Born, and Vice, all nominated for Best Picture, which, you know, isn't as diverse in the scales as, say, last year was when it came to Shape of Water and Lady Bird and everything in between.
Well, it's pretty diverse, though, if you know, really. There's musicals in here. There are two African-American-themed movies. There's a historical, a strange kind of historical reenactment movie, Spanish language film, Roma, something on recent American history in the case of Vice. So I think it spreads out pretty well. I think that it represents a great number of constituencies, if that's what the Academy is trying to do. And of course, they are very sensitive to the idea that it had become kind of the old white guys' club after a while. And I believe that they have done, you know, due diligence in trying to address that. The thing about that people need to keep in mind is that the Academy membership is not like the Shriners, where somebody puts your name up and you pay your due and you're in. You have to be part of the movie industry to begin with. And there is where the root of racism in entertainment in Hollywood comes in, because minority groups have been slowly accepted in Hollywood. They have been underrepresented forever. And this is beginning to change, and the Academy is beginning to reflect that. But the Academy, I think, is trying at least to take more of a leadership role in changing that.
When it comes to diversity spilling into other categories, I'd say, you know, lead actor, perhaps some people are left out of that, like John David Washington.
Right, John David Washington. If you're looking at diversity in the actor and leading role category, why wasn't he nominated instead of Viggo Mortensen for Green Book, for example? No skin off of Viggo's nose here, but I think that it would have been a better gesture not to nominate, you know, the white guy helping the black folks, but to nominate an actual African American in a historically based film.
Well, and the fact that some years it always seems to be the case where maybe something is nominated for Best Picture, but rarely do the actors get the same treatment, and don't they make it a Best Picture nominee?
Well, Best Pictures are compounded from many elements. So, I mean, there is a certain amount of divvying up the spoils that I think goes on here in the minds of some Academy voters and some members of the nominating committee. So that has to be taken into account. But also, I mean, what makes a best picture? There are so many elements. It could be visual. It could be the screenplay. It could be, I mean, really, it should be all of the elements, including the cast, that somehow come together in this scintillating chemical combustion of greatness, hopefully. And sometimes you can have a really good performance in a movie that lacks some of these other qualities.
For lead actor, we have Christian Bale for Vice, Bradley Cooper for A Star Is Born, Willem Dafoe for At Eternity's Gate, the film about Vincent van Gogh, Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody, and Viggo Mortensen for Green Book. Do you foresee this following the Golden Globe trend with Rami Malek once again taking
it? Well, I hope so, because it's one of my favorite movies, and I think it would be the way that film Bohemian Rhapsody will be acknowledged would be by Rami Malek winning. I think maybe, you know, Christian Bale on a certain technical level probably should win because of the difficulty of his role in playing Dick Cheney at various points in life and utterly disappearing into that character. But then Rami Malek kind of disappeared into the lead vocalist of Queen, Freddie Mercury, as well. So it's a good contest between the two of them. I think that Rami will make it.
I would agree that it's between Rami and Christian. Now, it comes to lead actress. We have Yalitza Aparicio for Roma, Glenn Close for The Wife, Olivia Colman for The Favorite, Lady Gaga for A Star Is Born, and Melissa McCarthy for Can You Ever Forgive Me, which I'm very pleased that she is nominated for that.
I am, too. It was one of my top movies of last year. I have a feeling, you know, Glenn Close, 7 times she was nominated for an Oscar and never the winner. Maybe it's time. I mean, the movie that she was in last year, The Wife, was re-released for theater during the nomination period. So there seems to be some push within the industry to put her forward. I think it would be kind of a shame if years go on and she dies without winning one during her lifetime. So I would tend to think that she might be a favorite here.
I would say Olivia Colman for The Favorite would be the second favorite.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that performance has generated a great deal of positive comment. And The Favorite, of course, we'll talk about Best Pictures, but, I mean, the movie it did quite well for itself in the nominating process.
Very true. So when it comes to supporting actor, Mahershala Ali, Green Book, Adam Driver, Black Klansman, Sam Elliott for A Star Is Born, which is surprising for a relatively small screen time. Richard E. Grant, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Another great performance. And Sam Rockwell for Vice.
Mahershala Ali for Green Book, I think, would be the one that would deserve it. And I have a feeling that there is sentiment like that in favor of giving the award to him. Sam Elliott, I think, is a case of honoring a longtime veteran. I don't think he's going to win in this particular case. Adam Driver. I mean, it's certainly a solid list of people, but I think that Ali should be the one to get it.
Now, when it comes to supporting actress, we have a few other nominees, two part of the same film, which can always put it in a tough competition. We have Amy Adams for Vice, Marina de Tavira for Roma, Regina King for If Beale Street Could Talk, Emma Stone, The Favorite, and Rachel Weisz for The Favorite.
Well, I think that Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz are running against each other here, as you say. I would like to give it to Amy Adams for Vice, because I have a feeling that Vice is going to be shut out of a lot of categories. And this, again, it could be a way of acknowledging that interesting movie. But again, when you look at the list, I mean, I don't think that Marina de Tavira has a constituency at this point in the Academy. Regina King, maybe. But again, Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz are competing with each other. So I think that odds would be in favor of Amy. And well-deserved. It was an excellent performance. Again, spanning decades in the life of a real character.
Now, when it comes to leading all of these people in their roles, Best Director, we have Spike Lee for Black Klansman, Pavel Pavlikovsky for Cold War, Yorgos Lanthimos for The Favorite, Alfonso Cuarón for Roma, Adam McKay for Vice.
Well,
which is a lot of competition. It's strong in all the cases.
That is good. Cold War is an excellent movie, but we can eliminate Pavel right away because I don't think, again, it's got the same prominence. Adam McKay for Vice, you know, a very good bit of directing there, but I just have a feeling it's not going to be up there in the top of the minds of most people in the Academy. The person who, in a certain sense, should get would be Spike Lee because he really should
totally
be.
Totally agree.
Yeah, he really should be recognized for three decades now of, provocative and sometimes really good and sometimes less so, but whatever. It's been a very long career doing something that has not been done enough of in Hollywood, films from an African-American perspective. But I have a feeling it's not going to be his year yet, that really the competition goes down to Roma and The Favorite because, I mean, they both have, 10 nominations altogether. They are tied, those two films. It would seem to me that because of that, there would be an emphasis on one or the other of those directors winning. And if I was going to choose there, Alfonso Cuarón, because I think he has a stronger Hollywood track record than Lanthimos does. But could go many directions.
Which might be making some people making their, office Oscar polls, a little upset considering a lot of things you're returning to is like, okay, what is their esteem level in Hollywood versus, okay, what's the enjoyment of the film or how well it's done?
Well, I'll point out that the attempt to do a popular film category was swatted down, and I think rightly so, because that does run against the mission of the Academy, which is to promote the artistry and the technology of filmmaking, not to register box office appeal. I mean, many times films far outside the mainstream in recent decades have won significant awards. Movies about, transsexuality, for example, 20 years ago in the late 90s with, Hilary Swank. I mean, that was kind of outside of consideration for the average moviegoer at the time. The Academy is sometimes, for all of its criticisms against it, they are sometimes ahead of the game.
Now, when it comes along that line of further emphasizing things that are outside of the audience norm, how about documentaries for this year? What are our top contenders?
Well, RBG on Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the prominent one. There's a prominent one that's missing here, and this, I think, is the one thing I find inexcusable about this year's Academy Awards, Won't You Be My Neighbor? a great documentary that did find a significant audience, was not even nominated. And instead of it being nominated, we have a variety of things here that really never made the big screen in Milwaukee, which means they didn't make the big screen in very many places at all. So why is that? So there's something really incomprehensible to me about why that was left off, but instead we have Free Solo, Hale County This Morning, This Evening, Minding the Gap, A Father's and Son. I mean, fine movies, you know, nothing against any of them. But given
considering how sometimes we can have nine or more nominees in categories some years, that
right,
make room for one more.
Yeah, why not? What was the problem here? I mean, but, you know, setting that aside, I think that RBG will win. I mean, it certainly generated an enormous amount of interest. And the subject matter, of course, is something that affects every American in some way, whereas these other movies are a little more focused on particular issues.
Yes. Now, when it comes to foreign language film, does it come down to distribution with foreign language film if it's made for and released in another country? Because Roma, you could argue, is a foreign language film.
It's up for foreign language also, as well as
Best Picture,
which is an interesting kind of a situation. Yeah, I mean, a foreign language film that has no American distribution is much less of a chance, of course. Many of these movies never look away. The German contender is opening in Milwaukee only, in February, mid-February. So most people around the country have never seen it. Capernaum has had very limited distribution. Cold War arrived in Milwaukee in January. So yes, I think Shoplifters, a kind of favorite on the film festival circuit, would normally be the movie I would predict would win this. I think it has a very good chance of winning. It has a nice kind of a sentimental, positive storyline about children and families. I think, though, that the unknown, the wild card here is Roma. Will the Academy give Roma Best Foreign Language Picture but not Best Picture? I mean, there is that kind of political consideration that maybe we'll pawn off the foreign language award to Roma, and that reserves the right to vote for something else for Best Picture.
Right.
Well, some people in the Academy will think about that. Whether it's the majority of them, we'll see.
Do you think that the Academy will have to reexamine or perhaps adjust protocols and rulings with the way they decide things? Because with Roma and Cold War, so there you have Netflix and Amazon Studios.
Right.
And, it's interesting how they are changing the landscape.
Well, they are studios, of course. They become studios, much to the chagrin, I think, of older studios in Hollywood. They have an advantage over it was an unfair advantage. I mean, they have the streaming systems. People, can watch movies by Netflix and Amazon from the comfort of their home. They don't have to go out and... I mean, there's probably a little fee for Prime viewing of certain things, but I mean, it's not like spending what has become an enormous amount of money to go out to a date night to the movie theater. So I think there is a real fear that this kind of thing will cut away at theatrical revenue, even though 2018 was a record-breaking year. Movie theaters did quite well last year, but there's still this anxiety that the world is changing and movie theaters, multiplexes in particular, will become somewhat irrelevant except for people lining up for the latest superhero movie.
Do you think that the Oscars are also going to need to reevaluate and readjust to see what their role is with the viewers of America?
Well, the viewers of America include Amazon and Netflix viewers now to a larger number than ever before. The studios and the Academy, it for a long time didn't want to pay particular attention to television. Television has its own awards. I mean, but what's been happening, of course, is that the lines between different categories of media have been blurring and overlapping. And let's look at the name, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. In the 1920s, there was only one kind of motion picture, what you would see on a big screen. We understand now more than ever that we're surrounded by motion pictures of one kind or other. I mean, in what way does the Academy have to take this into account in thinking about what its mission is? So we live in interesting times.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express newspaper and one of our regular film contributors. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you'll find more of our film segments, including some about this year's Oscar nominees, at WUWM.com.
We will take one more break and then catch up with Milwaukee native, cartoonist, and writer Paul Noth. Lake Effect continues with that in a moment on WUWM.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Who among us didn't have one of those days in middle school when you wished the world would end? Well, for Hap Conklin, that's actually a very real prospect. Conklin is the young, sometimes bearded character at the center of a series of middle grade novels by Milwaukee native Paul Noth.
The latest is called How to Properly Dispose of Planet Earth. And Noth, who is also a New Yorker cartoonist, joined us in the studio recently to give us a preview. Well, and so for people who are just catching up with Hap Conklin, remind us who he is.
Hap is he starts off in the fifth grade in the first book, and he has a very sort of large and crazy family that drive him crazy. In book one, he gets the opportunity to improve his situation by selling one particularly despotic member of his family to a group of aliens. But he doesn't realize that it's sort of a package deal, and it ends up he ends up selling his whole family to the aliens, and he has to get them back.
And here in book two, he has gone on, I believe, to middle school at this point.
Yes,
right?
He's now in sixth grade. He's things are going a little bit better for him. He's not as he doesn't feel quite as oppressed and frightened as he did in book one. He's a little more confident. Trouble starts when he meets a girl. Her name is Nev Everly, and he would really like for her to be his lab partner. only he is unable to speak in her presence. And he figures out a way that he could stop time in order to think of something clever and funny to say, and that would allow her, that would allow him to ask her to be his lab partner.
This is, of course, the dream of every sixth grade boy.
Exactly, exactly. But
I am still trying to think of the right thing to say to the girl that I wanted to make jokes to in sixth grade.
Right, exactly. And he thinks if he just had a little bit more time, he would be able to think of that reply.
There's a great series of cartoons, by the way, that goes along with that concept.
Right, where the way he has things planned and the way things actually turn out. A side-by-side comparison. Unfortunately, in the process of this, he accidentally opens a black hole when he tries to stop time, and now it's going to swallow his classroom and swallow the school, the Earth, the solar system, probably, unless he can figure out a way to stop the black hole.
And being able to do that involves the use of his faithful and sometimes not faithful lizard, Squeep.
Yes. Squeep the lizard has become a bigger and bigger part of the story. Hap isn't really sure if it's actually his lizard, because Squeep seems to have more of a life than Hap does and has a lot more going on. And so it's not so much his lizard as just a lizard that lives with him whenever it decides to live with him and shows up whenever it decides to show up.
I can't remember whether we covered this ground exactly, but you come from a relatively large family.
Yes.
How much of the very kind of complex relationship between the Conklin siblings and their father and their elders is taken or maybe exaggerated from what it was like with the Noth family experience?
It's I say it's not based on the Noth family, but I think it is based on the way it felt growing up in a family like that. I have two brothers and six sisters. We all lived on the east side in a 4-bedroom house. And so there was this sense of, you know, there was a sense of, I had a sense of like, it's unusual. I had a great loyalty and love for my family, and we're all still very close. But I also had a feeling of being, you know, of never having anything be my own, of people constantly being around, of, you know, a desire to get free of all of them all the time. And also a little bit of feeling unusual and like an outcast because of the family situation.
Well, and the Conklins, they're always these kind of shifting alliances. And I imagine when you're in a family like that, you know, you're always taking advantage of whatever alliance you can with whoever you can in whatever the situation dictates.
Yes. I grew up with this idea of like there's sort of a complicated group dynamic or sort of political palace intrigue going on among the siblings and who has power and who doesn't. And I feel like that's without me even trying to, I can't, even when I just draw a picture, I just add a lot of characters naturally. I've noticed that with comic artists that sort of were only children or came from small families. There's a lot of solitude in their panels. And with me, I just, from the time I was a kid drawing pictures, I just filled the page up with people because that was my reality. That was sort of the experience growing up.
Hap Conklin is not Calvin.
No, he's not. He does not have to sort of invent a companion. He has like almost too many companions is how he feels.
Well, and Hap's sister Alice turns out to wield this kind of immense power in the middle school where they both go to school, and you know, obviously exaggerated from a real life kind of experience, but I am not the youngest in my family, but I always kind of, you know, you talk about younger siblings going to school and having to deal with the specter of their older and more powerful siblings who have already been there.
Yes, that's definitely part of this book. And that does come from my experience. I think that's why I sort of picked up on that idea and it began to resonate with me. Alice in the first book, she sort of, you know, she steals everything that belongs to him. And that was a real feeling. And I think that might be, even if you have just a couple siblings, there might be that sense, that memory of that. But that I felt that way really strongly growing up, that I couldn't have anything that was mine. There was no particular sibling that Alice was based on. But I did have the feeling, especially of going into middle school and high school, of, you know, I had two older sisters who went before me. And there was a real sense of like, oh, that's their brother. In some ways, I realized that they were more impressive people than I thought they were because, you know, my older sisters, Jeannie and Felicia, they had this reputation that I could almost sort of ride on their coattails. But there was a disadvantage to that, too.
What are those get-togethers like today? I mean, there are a lot of funny people in your family.
Yes, there are. And I'm not one of the, and weirdly, I'm not one of them. Well, I have sort of a quiet sense of humor. And I like to draw everything down on a picture. And I wasn't, and people in my family, it tends to be, you know, who is the loudest and who's the quickest, you know, verbally. And so, you know, it's a lot of very, very, you know, smart, funny, clever people. So it's fun. But it's also there are still some of those complex dynamics going on that I mentioned earlier.
But I would imagine you would probably be top of the heap at, what is it, Pictionary, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I try and steer things towards Pictionary whenever possible.
So we talked a lot the last time, I think, about your cartooning. But I'm not sure I realized that fiction was initially your aim, right?
Yeah, well, it was in around the late high school and college. That's when I got into books, the kind of books you know, with words and not just, you know, words and pictures, books and especially science fiction. And then in college, I sort of gravitated towards that. And I was a writing major and I wrote some very strange literary fiction before I got around to doing this. But the first thing that sort of worked for me was comedy writing and cartoons. Those are the first things I began to sell. Cartoons to the New Yorker and comedy writing for, you know, various places, and Conan O'Brien and other places since then. And so my initial goal, though, what I kind of fell in love with first was storytelling.
What's the transition back and forth between reaching kind of the older audience that you write for with The New Yorker, presumably, and the somewhat younger audience here been like? I mean, do those two things, do you see them bleed over in any ways?
Sometimes. I feel like they're very different, and the only thing really that's connecting them is my sensibility in my work and what I have to get things to my own. For both audiences, I just do what I think is funny. You know, and try to do, you know, have my own point of view come forward.
But I wonder, you know, thinking about your sister and your somewhat famous brother-in-law, when they put together material, they get kind of instant feedback,
yes,
on whether it is funny and whether it has had its desired effect. What is it like for you to put this stuff out in the world thinking it's funny to you, but not necessarily knowing that you've reached the people you're intending in the way you're intending?
Yeah, it's a slower feedback loop, or I guess a larger feedback loop, because it takes more time for me to find out if people like the ideas as much as I do. And I think what that's, you know, I'm I think that I slowly build confidence in that, no, I like this. And sometimes I put it out there not knowing whether other people will like it, you know, and just like I have to really just trust my judgment as to whether or not they'll like it. And I think on one thing that's happened since the first book is I've been touring a lot more. I get questions from audiences of kids all the time.
Well, I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
What do you hear from them?
Well, I mean, the question I got every time was, where do you get your ideas? How do you become a writer? You know, and it was through answering that over and over again that I started to realize how much I rely on my notebooks and my sketchbooks to just capture everything so I remember it and then develop the ideas over time. So I always tell them that I don't actually remember writing the idea for How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. It was just one of my ideas in all these notebook ideas that I found one day. And I show them the page. I do a PowerPoint presentation for them, and I show them the particular page, and I show them all of the books that I carry around, and I recommend to them, especially the ones that are interested in doing creative things, that they carry around a book, just a bad idea book, I call it. I write bad idea on the front of a notebook, and I said, because it's just for you, and you don't have to, it frees you up, it allows you to be creative, and you can, you know, you can decide later whether who you want to share it with or whether you like it tomorrow. I think that's what's helped a lot. Like, in a way, the feedback I get is from myself tomorrow. You know, do I still like this? Is this still funny? And if it stays funny for me for a couple of days, or if it resonates with me the way that, you know, these stories do, you know, then I know that I'm onto something. Like this one, the second one, I feel like when I had the idea of talking to the girl being like something that could open a black hole and swallowing the universe. After that, the book came very quickly because I'm like, yeah, no, that's it. That's what it felt like, you know, when I was that age.
9 siblings growing up. There's a lot of pressure to, I imagine, with that many people around in a 4-bedroom space, get rid of a lot of things. And
yes.
The question is, do any of your earliest journals and notebooks still exist, or did they all go right after they were finished?
Unfortunately, none of them exist anymore. Now and then I'll hear from, you know, and I think that's just bound to happen with that many kids. Despite my parents' best efforts to preserve things.
No refrigerator large enough in the world.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. There's no refrigerator large enough, and you just have to assume that there's just going to be a certain amount of, like, you know, wear and tear on everything, that we're not going to have, you know, a TV or a stereo that lasts very long. You know, it'll just be broken eventually. It's little kids running around, that type of thing. So
you can, but in the end, you know, 30 years, 35 years down the road, there's not evidence of Paul Noth's earliest drawings.
Not that I know of, unless any of my teachers are listening. Maybe some of them still have. That's my only hope.
Have you looked on eBay?
Yeah, right.
Well, Paul Noth, congratulations on book number 2.
Oh, thanks so much. It was great to be here.
Milwaukee native Paul Noth's latest middle grade novel is called How to Properly Dispose of Planet Earth. It is the second in a trilogy. He's also a regular cartoonist for The New Yorker, and we spoke with him last month ahead of an appearance at Boswell Book Company. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.